much. Okay, thank you very much for coming to this talk. So I'll talk about conspicuous consumption and poverty. The question that I'm interested in is mainly persistence of poverty and among other things that are related to economic growth. And what we are doing here is taking more seriously some of the facts that that we know about the behavior of the poor around the world. And in particular, unlike a lot of previous research that ignored some of these facts, we want to take them into account. And the facts are that the very poor people around the world spend quite a lot of money on things that seem completely useless in alleviating poverty. This, of course, doesn't imply that these consumptions are useless in terms of utility, and they might have other benefits. We're not saying people are just stupid, but we're saying that they behave in a way that is a bit puzzling if we want to understand why people do not escape poverty and the persistence of poverty. And so the result is that they save at very low rates and poverty persists. So in particular, what we want to do in this paper is offer an explanation for these somewhat puzzling patterns. And the explanation we offer is conspicuous consumption. And therefore, we could claim that one could interpret what we observe as poor people, even the poorest around the world, people living off a dollar per capita a day, they still would like to distinguish themselves from their perhaps even poorer neighbors. And to do this, they have to engage in conspicuous consumption. This is, of course, just a hypothesis, but I'll try to convince you that it makes a lot of sense and is consistent with a lot of the evidence. Now, just by highlighting conspicuous consumption, we already go one step into understanding the puzzling behavior of the poor, and then we will offer a more specific mechanism in this paper, which is about a trade-off between observable human capital and conspicuous consumption. So let me say something about this trade-off. The idea is that if you go to that, okay, so your neighbors, perhaps think of you go to a high school reunion, what do your fellow friends from high school know about you at the moment? They don't know much. They might know that you graduated an MSc in Warwick. And even if they have no clue about your income, the fact that you graduated Warwick gives them some signal about your earning ability. And having this signal might allow you to reduce your other signals to the world. So the way I thought about this paper was trying to rationalize the fact that until recently I was driving a really old crappy car. And once in a while, I also get still invited to a class reunion, high school reunion, and I think, that's about a good time maybe to buy a nicer car, because everyone comes to the class reunion to show how successful they were in life. And then I think, well, what do my friends from high school know about me? They don't know much, but they do know I'm a professor in the university. So from this, they could infer that I have enough income to buy a reasonable car. And if they know I have enough income to buy a reasonable car, why spend the money on something that I don't really care about? Okay, so that's sort of the intuition we have here. But let's talk a little bit about the life of the poor. There is a fantastic survey by Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo in which they describe the life of the poor around the world. Again, people who live off less than $1 a day. And the facts are that they do not invest or almost do not invest in the education of their children. They are poorly fed. They suffer from health problems. They cannot afford going to see the doctor. They are worried about their situation and it bothers them. It's not that they are happily poor. They are bothered by it. And they fail to make trivial investments in their businesses. A lot of the very poor around the world are not employed by a firm. They are self-employed. They have their own little business. And they do not make trivial investments that could increase their income by a lot. And they save so little that when they suffer a temporary decline in income, they have to cut on their consumption. You might say all of this is not surprising. They are extremely poor. So what does it mean to be extremely poor? That's exactly this list and many other things that characterize the poor. Yet at the same time, the same people spend a large fraction of their income on alcohol, cigarettes, festivals, and other goods that seem to be completely useless in alleviating poverty in their long-run achievements of their life, their children, and so on. So this is sort of the puzzle we want to address. And of course, you might claim that offer different explanations for the same phenomena. So here is a recent article 2 years ago from the New York Times, 2.5 years ago. And the reporter argues the following. If the poorest families spent as much money educating their children as they do on wine, cigarettes, and prostitutes, their children's prospect will be transformed. And to establish this is of course not scientific research, it's more anecdotal, but he visits the Obamza family from Congo Republic. And this family is 8 months behind in paying the rent. So they might be evicted from their house. They have no mosquito nets, although they lost 2 of their 8 children to malaria. They do not afford, they cannot afford paying the school tuition. They are extremely poor. Okay, at the same time, Mr. and Mrs. Obamza spend $10 a month, more than the rent, on cell phone calls, using their cell phone. And Mr. Obamza goes drinking several times a month in the pub and spends $12 a month. Okay, look at the numbers. And then other villagers say that Mr. Obamza drinks less than the average man in the village. So you see the situation here. Very poor people, their children are out of school because they don't have $2.50 a month. But the guy is drinking with his friends and spending $12 a month. Is this conspicuous consumption? Perhaps. Drinking at home is obviously not conspicuous consumption, but going to the pub and buying a round of drinks to your friends is clearly conspicuous consumption. And the problem is that there are less productive ways to show your income. Okay, like for instance, you might think, well, how about instead of showing off in the pub, Mr. Obamza would send his child to a good private school. So you could imagine the friends meeting in the pub and everyone buys, you know, a round of drinks. And when Mr. Obamza's turn to buy drinks for his friends, he says, well, look, I'm not buying drinks, but trust me, this little boy is going to Harvard. It's not convincing, okay? More scientific research looking at marriage expenses in India, huge amounts of money, and the claim is that indeed this is highly related to the status of the family, and here are the numbers, 15% of household expenditure. So you think people are extremely poor, and just on marriages, they spend 15% of their income, before we look at jewelry, alcohol, cigarettes, other festivals. Yes, please.
Do we have comparative evidence on high-income countries? Like, I would imagine that conspicuous consumption is also quite a high.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's a very good question in the sense, Abida, you, so a good question, yeah? So typically, the literature on conspicuous consumption is always about wealthy people. I mean, the contribution we do here is we say, look, even the poor, the very poor, also spend their money on conspicuous consumption. I'll show you one piece of study that does look at it. So similar to the weddings in India, in South Africa, these are funerals. And again, look at the numbers. People borrow to have a big festival when there is a funeral, and the spending is 1 year income. I mean, it's huge amounts of money. People borrow at high interest rate, which pushes them deeper into poverty. And again, my interpretation, this is all conspicuous spending. Back to the New York Times, they provide fantastic articles on conspicuous consumption by coincidence, probably. So there is, again, back to India, a farmer who had a windfall of slightly more than $100,000 just by selling land. And so it's a very poor family that has this windfall. And the next thing he does, he takes about 8% of this windfall and just burns it on a helicopter ride. His son is getting married, and to take the son to the next village, they use a helicopter. And the entire, if you read the article, it's really fascinating. You could find it online. The neighbors, the experts, everyone just talks about, it's all about making a show. It's all about showing that now we are not at the same status we have been before. We have spending capacity. Here is the child, he's 19 years old, getting off the helicopter. Look at the wharf, he's wearing all of rupee notes. What could be more conspicuous than that? Here is some more evidence about conspicuous spending. So the president of Tajikistan was worried about conspicuous spending because he saw the impact it had on people's life. And he tried to ban stuff that is conspicuous signals in Tajikistan. So banning gold teeth, that's in some societies, that's a status symbol, and other things, using cell phones, festivals, and so on. And you see, read the quote. The president criticized wealthy citizens for showing off their wealth by throwing elaborate parties and thereby setting a standard for others who try to appear wealthy by holding a large party despite having only modest income, and people just burn their life savings to make a show. So that's your question about some. There's a lot of research, but that's an interesting example. Which I like because, so that's looking, one second, looking at spending in the U.S. across states, across different races, and what I care about is that they find that for the same level of income, people with higher education spend less on visible goods or conspicuous goods. Again, you could think that perhaps people that are better educated, they just behave differently, they have perhaps different utilities, but it is consistent with the claim we raise here. Yes, please.
Is there any evidence on the following argument that maybe many of these ultra-poor people, they live in an environment, like in villages, where as soon as they invest a bit, like get some returns, like improve their lot, like and due to insecurity, it's just the threat that they are robbed, that, or that like envious neighbors are just like pulling them, pushing them out of the community, like that. Any returns that they get from their investment
yeah.
are so insecure.
Yeah, I get. So what you're suggesting is that perhaps poor people cannot save because they don't want to become wealthier because of many different reasons. On the margin, actually, there are some evidence of this type, mainly children that work. And instead of bringing all the income back to their parents, they spend it every day. But by and large, this is not the case. We know that, in fact, it's a lot of time, what goes against this proposition is that people borrow heavily and become really poor based on that. So why do people care about status? For the sake of what we do here, we just assume it. We know that people, you know, if you live in this world, you know that people care about conspicuous spending. They care about their status. You just go out, you see the type of cars people drive on the roads, and so on and so forth. But still, it's interesting, why is it? And, well, I mean, if you look at how these people, their daily life, based on the Banerjee and Duflo survey, they have a lot of alternatives to do with their money. They could take care of their health, wear glasses when they need them, invest a bit in the education of their children. So the opportunity cost is huge. The best way to estimate it is by the interest rate. So we know that actually people in poor countries borrow and borrow at very high interest rate. An interest rate of 100% per year is very reasonable. Okay, so it's huge. So why do we care about status? So, I mean, you could think of this in coming from evolutionary psychology. So you could look, for instance, in Steven Pinker's book, How the Mind Works, and there he just brings a survey of claims and facts about the status being in our genes. And conspicuous consumption is something universal. In all societies, it is observed, although in different ways. And then some experiments done in psychology, so pretty women inspire men to behave like idiots in different way, and so on and so forth. So it's all about mating goals. It's not that people think in a direct way, I'll try to make a show, try to show I'm successful, because then I will have more mates. It's directly, it's like, you know, we eat not because we want to survive, we eat because we are hungry. So it's the same thing, we have this hunger for status. And it varies, by the way, across genders. More evidence, Missy Elliott, you know, she's not an academic, but still actually much more successful than the typical academic. And she talks about bling culture. I think today it's bling. And this is flashy jewelry worn especially as an indication of wealth. And she claims that this encourages young black men and women in the United States to spend their money irresponsibly, and that artists should encourage young people to invest responsibly in stable long-term assets. I would add, like, human capital. And an example of bling is the following. And in some places, this is the coolest thing. Of course, if I would enter here with a necklace of this type, you'll just think I'm an idiot. So all I'm saying here is that the type of bling we use varies. You see, I wear a nice suit. Okay, then you think I'm cool, but not this. Actually, this looks really cool. How about this thing? People who have, for the academics here, the more senior ones with a research budget, here is what you should do with it. And not just universal across human societies, bling exists in nature. And the peacock's tail is clearly a burden, okay? I mean, the peacock tries to avoid becoming prey, and carrying this big tail is not very helpful, but the ladies or the peahens are impressed, okay? It's a signal for something, and they want this in their for their offsprings. So related literature, I think I talked, I say that the idea of conspicuous consumption is not new. The contribution we make here is to talk about poor people. Let's skip this. And let me talk now a bit more technical about poverty traps, how it works and what we do here. Okay, if there are any questions at this stage, don't hesitate. Okay, so a standard poverty trap is to understand why there is persistence of low income among people who started poor. So if the father is and mother are poor, then their children would be poor. And for instance, they cannot, if the parents are poor, they don't have enough money to invest in the education of their children. So the children don't have education. As a result, they are poor, and therefore they do not have money to invest in the education of their children. And you see how poverty, just based on this story, could persist. But the nice thing about economics is that we don't just stop with stories. We want to write down a model. And sometimes when you write down a model, you discover some interesting things. For instance, that the story I just told you doesn't really work unless you add some additional elements. How do you see this? So for instance, think of the horizontal axis here as the income of the parents, and the vertical axis, this bequest, or think of this as investment in the education of the children. And in economics, we like homothetic preferences just for the sake of the standard simple example. So this means there is a linear relationship between B and Y. And then there is some standard production function with, for instance, with decreasing marginal productivity. So the higher is B, the higher would be the income of the offspring in the future generation. So you see the combination of these two figures generates a mapping from the income of parents in period T to the income of their offspring when they are adults in period T plus one. So we could combine the two figures, and if we add, okay, so that's the combination from yt to yt plus one, you add a 45 degree line and you get this very simple dynamical system in which you see that for low levels of income, that's the yt plus one function, phi function, lies above the 45 degree line, which is the identity curve. So if the phi function is above the 45 degree line, this means that the offspring will have a higher income than the parent. Okay, so income would grow over time. And on the right of y bar, income will shrink over time. So what you see from this figure is that we get a single equilibrium, a steady state, no poverty trap. Poverty does not really persist. Over time, the poor accumulate wealth and they all converge to the same level of income. What we really want, so that's the same figure I just showed you. We want the phi function to cross the 45 degree line more than once. Here you could see, without getting into the technical details, an example, so I just played with it, no explanation behind so far. I'm just telling you what kind of figure I want in order to generate a poverty trap. And here you could see that there is a low income steady state, which is stable, and a high income steady state, which is stable, and a threshold in between, such that people who started wealthy enough converge to the high income steady state, and those who started poor converge to the low income steady state. So here we have a poverty trap. So the entire literature in poverty traps is how could we explain this type of dynamics? And what most of the literature did was, let's play with the technology. For instance, let's assume some investment thresholds. So you see, instead of a standard continuous concave production function, we have an investment threshold with a jump. And once we have, so for instance, you could, as a story that people tell is that in order to get education, higher education, you cannot just go for half a year or 1 year to college. You have to go for 3 years. And you have to be wealthy enough to do it. So you cannot gradually climb out of poverty. There is this wall, this investment threshold you cannot pass. So that's one approach. It's criticized because of many reasons, in particular the idea that even when you think of a specific technology, if this threshold exists, maybe there are alternatives in the market. So, okay, I don't have enough money to go to a college degree, maybe I have enough to just get some other type of education, which is shorter and cheaper, to be a technician or something like that, okay? So an alternative approach, so this, of course, it does the job, but we would like to take more seriously the facts about the behavior of the poor. So an alternative approach would be, don't touch the technology, but play with the preferences or the behavior. In particular, as in one of my previous papers, just assume that the saving rate increases with income. That's a very reasonable assumption, because we know when we look at the data, the fraction of income allocated to saving increases with income. And once this happens, this is sufficient to create a poverty trap. However, and how do you justify it? Well, one way to justify it is subsistence. You could start saving only above some subsistence level. Okay? Sounds reasonable, right? But then what about all the facts we just saw about the poor? If they were really in subsistence, people cannot spend 20%, 25% of their income on stuff that doesn't help them survive. So just saying subsistence isn't sufficient. A different paper of mine addresses the issue of fertility. We know, again, taking seriously some of the facts about poor people, we know that the poor have on average more children, investing less in the education of each child. This could generate this type of dynamics. And let me briefly talk about Banerjee and Mulaniton. What they claim, so they're the first, actually, they deserve the credit to incorporate in a theory, in a model, the facts about the poor, the same facts we address here, but they provide a different interpretation. They interpret this as temptation. Okay, so their story is that people, and in particular the poor, have problems with self-control. So the idea is like you go to a restaurant and you decide ahead of, before you go, you decide I'm not taking dessert because I want to save money or because I'm on a diet. But then, you know, the waitress comes with the list of desserts and we do order desserts. And at the moment you order the dessert, you already know that you will regret it, but still we do it. So that's temptation, and we're subject to temptation. To get their poverty trap, they assume, it's an assumption, that poor people spend a larger fraction of their income on temptation. And in a sense, theoretically at least, this is not very elegant, because that's almost assuming the results. Because if people spend a larger fraction of their income on temptation goods, then they save less. The story in the paper is more complicated than that, but we don't have much time, so I will not go into it. So back to the paper here. What is the specific mechanism we have? Because as you could understand from the slides I showed you initially, if I just assume that people spend a constant fraction of their income on conspicuous consumption, this will not generate a poverty trap. What I need is that poor people spend more as a fraction of their income, not more in absolute value, as a fraction of their income on conspicuous consumption, and as a result, they save at a lower rate. And this could generate a poverty trap. Okay, so what we have here is a very simple technology, what we call in economics an AK technology. It's just linear. So constant returns or no decreasing marginal productivity. So similar to the same figures we had before. And let's again assume homothetic preferences. So people want to allocate constant fractions of their income to different goods. And what I will show you here is, so this generates this type of dynamics, endless growth, okay? No poverty trap. Now suppose that we introduce conspicuous consumption into this model and people spend a large fraction of their income on conspicuous spending, so they save less. So this entire five function drops. What do we get here? If everyone spends a constant fraction of income on conspicuous consumption, then we might have this result with, again, only one level of income, which is an equilibrium, a steady state. So again, we don't have a poverty trap in the sense that the poor stay poor and the rich become rich and richer, okay? So what we really do here is that's the reason we add human capital. What is the intuition? As people accumulate human capital, they become wealthier. And as they become wealthier, since it is based on human capital, which is observable, they spend less on conspicuous consumption. And that's why we get this tilt in the phi function, endogenously as a result of the signaling equilibrium. Okay? And so again, what you get here is that there is some threshold below everyone that is in this range, initial income, initial low levels of human capital, spends quite a lot as a fraction of income on conspicuous consumption, and as a result is trapped in poverty. Whereas people who have high levels of human capital, instead of spending their money on conspicuous consumption, they invest in education, the education of their children, and the family accumulates wealth over time, which technically is not blocked, but you could always block it at some level. Doesn't matter. Okay, so that's basically the result of the model. So let me stop here for a few minutes, allow you to ask questions, make comments, and then if we have time, I'll go a bit deeper into the model. You want me to show you just a taste of the model? I'll just illustrate something simple.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. I'm not going into the model at all. Here is just a simple illustration of what is a separating signaling equilibrium. Okay, it's not the paper. It's just an illustration.
We all know about signaling equilibrium. They better know about it.
Okay, let's see if you know. So suppose again, it's just a way to illustrate a signaling equilibrium without. It's not the model of the paper. So suppose people have an income of, we're living in a place, half of the population has an income of 8 and half have an income of 12, okay? This is well known, but we do not know who makes 8 and who has 12. And the utility function is W minus X, that's the income, X is conspicuous consumption. So people spend, they have a simple decision to make. How much of their income to spend conspicuously, which is simply think of this, they take the money and just tear it up in public. Okay, no utility whatsoever, just from the signal. Okay, they just burn money. So that's X, and S is their status. What is the status? How much income people think they have. Okay, so for instance, if I have $8, and I don't burn any of it, and people know I have £8, then my utility will be 8 multiplied by 8, okay? So now let's think of the equilibrium. Suppose these are the beliefs. If someone burns £3 or more, we think this is the rich guy, has £12. If someone does not burn at least £3, we think this is the poor guy that has £8, okay? So of course in equilibrium, if the signal of 3 or more is the same, then people will always just burn or exactly £3 or 0, right? And then we see that X would be 3 or 0. And let's see if this is an equilibrium, okay? In which the rich actually burn £3 and the poor burn nothing. So we have to look at this table. Here is the income level and here is the decision. Should I burn 0? Or 3. If I burn 0, my utility is 8 multiplied by 8, 64. I consume all my income, I do not burn any money in public, and as a result, people think I'm poor. And then they are right. Now, I could disguise myself as a rich guy. I have £8, but I still could burn £3, and then people think I'm rich. Okay, what will be my utility? Then I consume only 5, multiplied by high status 12, utility 60. So you see, I'm better off not showing off. And similarly, you could see that actually the rich guy is better off making a show. And here you get this separating equilibrium. Okay, that's sort of the flavor of the idea.
Thanks a lot. Let's raise the hands to Omar for the talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.